Scott, let's start with your new book with Anya Kay talking about the conflict in Ukraine. And it's a very important book. I have just read it. And could you elaborate on this book and what you bring with this book to us?
Sure, I'll just show the people the cover of the book. Title of the book's Covering Ukraine. It's the Scott Ritter interviews through the eyes of Anya Kay. Just a backstory, my publisher, Clarity Press, had been pressuring me for some time now to write a book on Ukraine, on the Ukraine conflict. And indeed, we had a contract for such a book, and I was supposed to deliver the manuscript in August of 2022. But I stopped it because I told the publisher that as soon as you publish this, it's going to be out of date, that this war is a moving target. And they didn't like that answer until September came around and Ukraine launched a major offensive that pushed Russian forces out of the Kharkov area, recaptured the right bank of Kherson, prompting 300,000 partial mobilization by Russia, a referendum which brought Kherson, brought the four new territories into Russia as part of Russia, changing everything, which is what I said would happen. And ever since then, I've been pushing back. I said, no, this is a forever changing story. It's a very difficult story to tell. We're now in, I think, the most stable part of the conflict. And what I mean by that is we're locked in a war of attrition right now. It's a war where Russia and Ukraine, working as a proxy of NATO, are engaged in attritional warfare, and the side that runs out of stuff first loses. And it appears that Ukraine is the side that's running, Ukraine slash NATO is the side running out. So now's the time when a book is justified, but it comes at a time when I have no time to write a book. And so the question was how to move forward. And I said, I reflected back on my experience in 2002 in the lead up to the Iraq conflict. There was a wonderful journalist named William R Rivers Pitt who did a series of interviews with me, which we turned into a book called War on Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know. It's a very successful book. I think 175,000 copies were sold in the United States, almost a quarter of a million were sold abroad. I didn't get a penny of it, though, because context. Publishers went bankrupt after 9/11, and I think my book was the only one that made money, and they seized all the money to pay off the assets. But that's okay. The purpose of the book was to inform an American and international audience about the lies being told about the Iraq is a threat. And I said, why don't we do a book like that? And Clarity Press, Diana Collier, the publisher reflected on it. She said, okay, I think that would could be a an interesting book. Who do you want to be the person interviewing? And then the question came down, who has the time to do it? And then once we do it, what questions are going to be, how are we going to focus on it? And then I myself was doing a lot of traveling, getting ready for this big trip to Russia that didn't happen, but still required a lot of preparation. And I said, I don't know if we could do this. And then Anya Kay, a podcaster from Poland, bothers me all the time saying, we want to do an interview. I want to do an interview. I want to do an interview. I want to do an interview. And I love being interviewed by you. I love being interviewed by her. I love being interviewed by everybody. I mean, it's great process of question and answer and dialogue. And I said, oh, okay, I'll find time. And I did the interview. And as she's talking to me, a light bulb went off in my head, and I said, this girl's been talking to me since the beginning of the war. And she asked very probing questions, very in-depth questions. I think we already have the interviews done. All we need to do is capture them. So when the interview ended, I talked to her. I said, look, what would you think about taking questions from the interviews that you've done with me and turning it into a book? And she liked the idea. And then she worked very hard. I have to say that the questions that are in this book were picked by Anya Kay. Out of a whole host of interviews that we've done, she selected the questions that, from her point of view, best represented her process of understanding the war through interviews with me. And that's the important part of this book, because there's a lot of people out there that, you know, say, hey, we'd like to know more about this conflict. We'd like to know more. They have questions. And when you read this book, it's as if you're asking the questions. You become Anya Kay. She becomes your proxy. She's asking the questions that the readers have. And then I provide answers that are hopefully, you know, up to the task of responding to the question in a responsible manner. 19 chapters, 19 questions. She lays it out. We cover the war in terms of its chronology, although the book is not laid out chronological in terms of the questions. It's laid out more as a narrative of understanding, of comprehension. But we also, you know, we cover every facet of this conflict, from, you know, the legalities of the conflict to what the war is like, to the potential of nuclear conflict, the potential of a diplomatic settlement. We run the entire thing. So the scope and scale of all the questions that people might have about the Ukraine conflict are found in this book covering Ukraine. We were very fortunate to have Andrei Martyanov write a foreword for this book, and Larry Johnson, the former CIA analyst, write an afterword for it. And then the other interesting thing is, you know, the book covers a question taken from an interview, and you read it, you see it in words, but you don't really capture the emotion of the interview, because some of these interviews were pretty emotional. I mean, they get intense, especially with Anya Kay asking it, because, you know, she has a huge heart, and that soul of hers comes out through the questioning. So at the end of each chapter, we provide a QR code so that the reader can take their phone, click on the QR code, and suddenly you have the interview itself, and you can, it's a multimedia experience. The book's only 120 pages. You could read it at a sitting in the beach, but I can guarantee you this, you won't read it once. You'll go back to it. It'll become a reference. It's a small book, but it's got a lot of information. It'll become a reference, not just because of the questions, but because of the interviews. You'll go back and watch the interviews. And in combination, we cover Ukraine. We cover the Ukraine conflict. That's the title of the book, Covering Ukraine. I think it's come out at a really interesting time, because it hasn't been overcome by events. You get this book, you read this book, and you're up to speed on this conflict. You know, we have a NATO summit in Washington, D.C. right now, where NATO is talking about, you know, the future of NATO as it relates to the Ukraine conflict. A lot of decisions are going to be made between now and November. A lot of people are wondering, how does Ukraine conflict factor into my vote come November? 120 pages, people. Read the book. You will empower yourself with knowledge and information. It's a book I'm very proud of. I mean, it came together. I told the story of how it came together in an unconventional manner, but I couldn't have planned this book any better. I mean, I think everybody who's seen it, you were sent a copy. You were kind enough to write a very nice blurb promoting the book. I think the people who have read it are impressed by the book, by the substance of the book. And I think if you buy it and you read it, you'll be empowering yourself. Look, I keep saying buy it. Authors live by their writing. I mean, I write articles for various outlets. They pay me. That helps me pay my bills. And so, yes, I have a little bit of a selfish interest in trying to promote and sell this book. But this book, to me, like the War on Iraq book, if I personally made no money, but everybody was able to read this book, I'd be very, very happy. I have alternative sources of income. I can live without this book selling. Anya Kay dedicates herself to her podcasts, and she makes a modest stream of income off her podcast. I would encourage people to buy this book to support Anya Kay. You know, when you buy this book, she of course gets the royalties from this book. But again, because this is a book that is multimedia, you'll be exposed to her interviews, to her podcast. Subscribe, help her out. In this day and age of alternative media, I mean, I don't pry into how you earn a living, but I assume that at least some aspect of your income stream comes from the podcast. You put a whole bunch of time into them. If you want, you know, this podcast to continue, you have to support the person who puts on this podcast. You have to subscribe. You have to assist. If you want Aaron Maté, who gave a brilliant interaction with an Israeli propagandist on the Piers Morgan show, if you want him to survive and support him, Max Blumenthal, Judge Napolitano, others, even myself, I have a modest little podcast. Support the people that provide you with the information. A lot of time and effort goes into the preparation of this. You ask some outstanding questions, so I know that you spend, I would imagine, hours going through the news and probably saying, "How would Scott? How can I get Scott best to respond? How would I?" You know. So look, I know your style. That's why I keep coming back to you, because you ask me questions that provoke me, and I like being provoked, and I like the answers that I give to your questions. Maybe someday you and I should do a collaboration of this nature too. But the point is, Anya Kay deserves support. She deserves everybody's support, just like as much or even more than others. And so, you know, buy the book, support Anya Kay, and you'll be supporting alternative media at a time when alternative media is most needed. And this is this critical time, and not just American history, but world history. This is about global affairs. Our audience, I would imagine your audience, isn't an American exclusive audience. It's a global audience. And that's the importance of social media. We're not just shaping, you know, the opinions of an isolated group of people. This is about bringing everybody. This is really the glue that makes multipolarity work. So, you know, buy the book, support Anya Kay, support alternative media, and support yourselves, empower yourselves through knowledge and information. But again, I want to thank you for reviewing the book and writing the blurb that you wrote. You know, that kind of support is much appreciated.
And my pleasure. And I'm going to put the link in the description of this video. Anybody who sees this video can reach the book through the link in the description.
And just to add, the book is number one on Amazon for the Russian Soviet era. That's not number one of all books. I mean, we're never going to compete with some of the fantastic summer fiction that's out there, you know, but when it comes to Russia, Soviet Union, that's a big category that has a lot of heavy hitters writing in it. And for the moment, covering Ukraine is number one, which shows that people, you know, are finding the book to be of interest. So if you're out there on the fence, it's number one on Amazon for a reason, guys. Go out there and help it stay number one.
Amazing. Yeah. Scott, let's get started with this new attack on Children's Hospital in Kiev. They're talking about putting the blame on Russia. And what's your take on this attack?
First of all, let's stop calling it an attack on a children's hospital. Children's Hospital wasn't attacked. To be attacked, I'm somebody who used to attack places. People like me have to go through the imagery, find the target, define the target, quantify the target, do an evaluation of the target structure, determine what damage we want to the target, and then allocate the resources necessary to achieve that damage. That's how you attack a facility. So to call this an attack, Russia would have said, we want to achieve this result at this facility. And then they would have allocated a resource and they would have launched that, and that would have hit the facility to achieve the desired effect. If the children's hospital was attacked by a KH-101 cruise missile possessing a warhead of nearly 1 ton, it wouldn't exist today. It would have been leveled, flattened, et cetera. Worst case for Russia is that this was a KH-101 that either malfunctioned, which is highly unlikely, or was deflected off of its trajectory by Ukrainian air defense. That's the worst case. And I'm not dismissing that possibility. I have been very aggressive, probably too aggressive, given my status as an intelligence officer who's supposed to wait and receive all of the data before committing to a narrative. I think I let my anger towards Ukraine manifest itself in some very aggressive tweets that postulated that this wasn't a KH-101, this was a NASAMS missile. I still feel that that's a possibility, but I have to be honest, I made a mistake. I'm a professional military analyst. My reputation hinges on the fact when I commit to a narrative that narrative should be as as close to provable as possible. Nothing's ever 100% provable, but that, and I let anger and emotion get the better of me. But I'm not walking away from that because, you know, the Russian ambassador to the United Nations, who's an extraordinarily experienced diplomat on one of the largest stages in the world, where a Russian lie would be exposed and would embarrass Russia, and Russia's not in the business of becoming embarrassed by its own mistakes, has committed to this being an attack by NASAMS. Now, there's a couple reasons why his narrative makes sense. One, again, if a nearly one-ton warhead went off next to that building would be gone. Well, people are saying, well, how can, if this was a NASAMS, how can a, you know, 19-kilogram, 30-pound warhead do that kind of damage? Never forget that it was NASAMS. It would also have the solid rocket, the solid fuel propellant that could also blow up. The damage was heavy, heavier maybe than you would expect with that. Some people are saying it could have been a Patriot. I don't know. I can tell you this, that given my background, you give me an hour and a half at that site, I will prove what the weapon system was, without a doubt. And the fact that the Ukrainians haven't laid out the forensic evidence to back up their assertion that this was a KH-101, you know, finding the missile, the pieces, the serial numbers, all the things, leads you to believe that there might be more to this story than what the Ukrainian narrative is. The other thing is, the Russians, again, they attacked Kyiv, and they know what they were going. They were going for the industrial facility that's nearby the children, which again raises a question. Why is a children's hospital co-located to a known defense industry facility? Doesn't make too much sense, but that's okay. That's Ukrainian business. The Russians know what they wanted to do. Somebody like me who speaks Russian, wears a Russian uniform, looked at a photograph and said, this is the place we want to hit. They don't just randomly hit it. They pick impact points. Each impact point with the weapon, the KH-101, is designed to achieve the results they want. So they hit a building seeking to destroy what's in that building, and they hit it several times. The Russians know full well how many KH-101s they launched. And they know full well how many impacts there were in the facility, which tells me that if one went astray, if they launched five and there were five explosions and one of the five explosions was at the children's hospital, if I were the Russians, I'd be like, maybe one of our missiles went off target. But if they launch X number of missiles and they get X number of impacts in the target area and then one additional impact elsewhere, the Russians might have a right to say, that ain't ours. Not ours, something else. And then they're very specific about it. A NASAMS missile provided by Norway based in Kyiv, which tells me they know exactly where the surface-to-air missile system was. And the Russians being the Russians, if they're like us, they're monitoring this with intelligence collection capabilities. They know when anti-air missiles were fired, and they know what happened to them. They can track them. These are not unknowns, and the Ukrainians also know this, and so does NATO. This isn't something that just happened out of the blue. There's a whole bunch of data out there that shows this. I mean, if I were the Ukrainians again, I would go out and say, nope, this was the NASAMS. This NASAMS fired, you know, this many missiles. We have this here. We can account for each one. We know where it went. We have the radar tracking of it. Show us the data. I mean, if you really want to condemn. And they say, well, that's sensitive. Well, I don't know, man. At the United States, it would have been the perfect time for the United States to pull, you know, the kind of maneuver we did with the Cuban Missile Crisis, where they're like, we don't have any missiles in Cuba. Bam, photograph, there. How do you respond to that? Embarrass them. The Russian ambassador just committed to a narrative. If you've got the stuff, embarrass him. This is the time to do it on that stage. They didn't do that. You know, the shooting down of KL-007, the 747 back in the 1980s. Russians were, oh, it was an accident. Man, we declassified the intercepted communications and played them. Yolki polki, if you remember. Fiddlesticks, as the guy talked. They knew what they were shooting down. We proved it. Why aren't we putting that evidence out there right now? I mean, we got it. We got the data. We have it. This is the way the world works today. Why? Because it was probably a Ukrainian air defense missile that went astray and hit outside the children's hospital. That is the probable direction I'm heading here now, because I don't have access to the forensics, but I know damn well what happens. Remember, I used to do this for a living. I used to be the guy tracking all this stuff, collecting against it, knowing how to read the tracks, knowing what the tracks mean, putting together the briefs to explain to people what happened. The Ukrainians aren't doing this. The Russians have committed. Now, the Russians, you know, they may not want NATO to know how much they can collect, et cetera. But the Russians are confident. They have committed to a very strong narrative, a very strong and specific narrative. And again, if I'm on the Ukrainian / NATO side, and I have data that can contradict that, man, I put that data on the table right now, right now. You know, the longer the Ukrainians take to collect forensic data at this site, the more likely it is they're picking up KH-101 parts from other places and put forward a false narrative. You should have come in quick. You should have had a chain of custody, videotape the whole thing, pick up the piece, seal the piece, you know, keep it under custody, unlock it in front of the media, lay it out, do the analysis in front of the media so there can be no question that that piece came from this site. It's too late now for Ukraine. You screwed that one up, but you do have radar tracks. You do have the launch logs. There's somebody at the NASAMS site that tracked incoming KH-101 missiles, and decisions were made either manually or automatically to fire NASAMS missiles to intercept. And you know when they were fired and you know what happened. You tracked that. It's part of the way that works. And you know if one went off and if one landed. They know damn well what happened. And the fact that the Ukrainians are silent right now lends me to put more faith in the Russian narrative than the Ukrainian narrative.
It seems that Poland plans to establish a no-fly zone over Lvov. And here comes the fear and the question, is NATO planning to send ground forces or even F-16s using this no-fly zone concept?
Well, I mean, in theory, if you want to insert forces into Western Ukraine, one way to do that is to create a no-fly zone. And an aspect of the no-fly zone is to have air defense umbrella extend over Western Ukraine. Here's the problem. Here's the fly in that ointment. The first time the Poles fire a surface-to-air missile against a Russian missile over Ukrainian soil is the last time they fire a missile. This will be immediately responded. I can't speak on behalf of the Russians, but I just can't imagine they would let Poland get away with this. And remember, Poland's doing this as part of a bilateral security agreement between Poland and Ukraine. It's not part of a NATO thing. So Poland has undertaken a security arrangement outside the framework of NATO. They don't get Article 5 protection here. And so this will open up the window for people like Hungary, like Turkey, like Bulgaria, who say, we don't want a war with Russia. We're not going to support Poland in this unilateral effort. I think the Poles are doing a sort of a test balloon kind of thing, throwing that out there to see where NATO stands. He announced it on the eve of the NATO summit. I'm sure he's going to get feedback during this summit. Hopefully the feedback is no, don't do it. But if you do it, you know, you're on your own. We're not here to protect you. And I'd go a step further for the United States. I say you're behaving grossly irresponsible in a manner that's inconsistent with American policy. We will no longer base troops in Poland. We're withdrawing our troops. We're withdrawing our Patriot missiles. We're withdrawing everything. You're on your own, Poland. That's the way we should respond. We probably won't. But, you know, this is a grossly irresponsible action by Poland. I think the Poles understand that it's not realistic to do this. I think this is about political posturing. Poles are hoping, I believe, for pushback that allows them to say, well, we can't do it because we don't have support, but we were willing to do it. Sort of like France saying they're going to send thousands of troops into Western Ukraine when you knew damn well they weren't, because they don't have them. Poland can't do this. They don't have sufficient air defense forces to do this. I don't know what they're thinking. You know, it's not as though their air defense is layered in depth inside Poland, nor to reach that 160-kilometer depth into Western Ukraine to cover Lvov and the approaches, you have to bring your air defense systems right up to the border. And the Russians are going to say, spasiba, and they're going to blow it up. So this is stupidity in the extreme on the part of Poland. If they go forward with this, and if NATO decides to back them up, then we have the Third World War and we all die in a nuclear holocaust, because this will be kind of a trigger a cycle of events of escalation that is as inevitable as it is predictable, and the outcome is certain.
Is Ukraine going to get anything positive in the eyes of Ukrainians out of this NATO summit?
You know, Zelensky's already bragging, you know, Norway's given us six more F-16s. Tell me when they arrive, pal. You know, everybody's been giving you F-16s now for over a year. When's the first one flying over Ukrainian airspace? Haven't seen it yet because it's impractical, because it's a suicide mission. You know, Romania has given us a Patriot system. Germany has promised us a Patriot. Okay. You've had some. They keep getting destroyed. I think just last week, two more got destroyed, freshly deployed. Keep sending them in. It's not going to change anything. People need to understand that when the first Patriots arrived into Ukraine, they did so under an existing integrated air defense umbrella that consisted primarily of S-300 Soviet-era surface-to-air missiles, very capable systems. And it had other systems, the Buks and everything else, layered air defense. And so the Patriot could come in, set up, and be relatively protected while it's being set up. That integrated air defense system is gone, finished. Why do you think Russia was able to hit downtown Kiev without any repercussion? Because there's no air defense system. The NASAMS that's there can't operate properly. I mean, I think this is one of the problems, is they can't cue the radar full stop because they'll get killed. So basically they're coming up with stopgap measures, maybe, you know, using another radar to cue, and then they fire in hopes that this radar picks it up and guides in. But if it malfunctions, the missile goes crazy and lands where it does. There's any number of things, but they don't have a functioning air defense system. So all these systems that are being promised to them, the best case is that they might be able to, you know, bring it in and put it around an airfield near Lvov or in Western Ukraine. But what we're seeing is that the Russians every day are hitting that. So every time they try to do that, bam, the Russians hit it because they get set up. There's no existing air defense umbrella. They're not secure. Before they can go operational, they're getting hit. So this is just literally throwing good money after bad. And Ukraine is a horrible investment right now. And other things that come out of the NATO summit is they acknowledge that they can't produce enough equipment. NATO collectively, these great industrial giants of the West, are incapable of producing enough military equipment to match the needs of Ukraine on the battlefield. That Russia, they've acknowledged, Russia has won the war of attrition. Russia's defense industry has been able to not only keep a pace with this conflict, but also meet the needs of an expanding, growing Russian military, as well as the casualties that have taken place. Russia is getting stronger every day. Ukraine is getting weaker, and the West can't replace this. The West doesn't have the industrial capacity to replace what is being destroyed. So Ukraine's getting weaker, weaker, weaker. This is literally the definition of attrition warfare, and it leads to the inevitable outcome of Russia overwhelming Ukraine. This is the reality of what's happening. So whatever is being promised to Zelensky is just material that's going to be thrown in. What are you going to do? He says he needs 128 F-16s. Where are you going to base them, Zelensky? That's question number one. Now, if you think you're going to operate them out of Romanian and Polish airfields, we come back to the same discussion we had about the Poles firing missiles. You launch an aircraft from an airfield that isn't Ukraine, and that aircraft enters Ukrainian airspace and participates in combat operations against Russia. That airfield is now a target, and I believe Russia will take that target out. That's just the way it is. Russia is not going to allow this incremental expansion to create, you know, to allow these NATO nations to become active participants in the war and not pay a price. Russia has been warning the West over and over and over again that that is a red line that just you can't cross it. It's a hard red line, and the consequences will be nuclear war. There we go. And the Russians now are rethinking their nuclear posture. It used to be that they would wait until NATO did something like launch a conventional attack or launch a nuclear attack. But the Russians are saying they're going to lower the threshold now. Why does Russia, knowing that NATO is committed to the strategic defeat of Russia, why would Russia sit back and allow NATO to accumulate the military power or the conditions under which military power can be applied, such as launching from NATO bases, going in and coming back and not being attacked, to the point where they can actually act on their desire to strategically defeat Russia? Right now, Russia is not strategically defeated, but can Russia afford to allow NATO? You know, one of the things they're going to be talking about this summit is how to build up this military, this NATO capacity. If Russia thinks NATO's serious about that, and you match it with Actions like Poles firing missiles into Western Ukraine, creating a no-fly zone, Romanians and Poles allowing their base to be used to launch F-16s against Russia. I think the Russians have every right to preempt. And I think that preemption will be decisive in nature. I think the Russians now, this is something that's been going on in Russian academic and intellectual circles, not necessarily coming out of the Russian government, but they've been talking about nuclear preemption, to fire a tactical nuclear weapon and take out a Polish target or a city. And one article that postulated this last year said, what would America do when Russia takes out Poznan, a Polish city? Boom, gone. You're going to sacrifice Boston for Poznan? That was literally the question asked in there. Joe Biden, are you willing to sacrifice Boston for Poznan? Knowing that the Poles provoked this, knowing that it was their actions that did this. It's a fair question. I don't want to know the answer, to be honest, because I think I know what the answer would be. Yes, the United States can't sit back and allow Russia to launch a nuclear weapon against a NATO ally, and that under Article 5, we would then launch a limited retaliation using the B-61 bomb or a Trident missile fired from a submarine, and we would hit a Russian target, and then it's all over, because the Russian response from there is immediate. It's not to hit pause, it's to hit the button, and everything flies, and then we will go, oh my God, and we will hit the button, and everything will fly, and then we'll all be dead within 40 minutes. That's where we are. It's a very, very dangerous situation. So Zelensky, people really need to pull him into check. It's time to end this war. Really. It's time to bring this war to an end. In NATO, you're not going to get the terms that you want. Russia's laid out a deal that's the best deal you're going to get. Ukraine will never be NATO. NATO expansion has been checked. That's the thing of the past. It's not something. You've already done what you can do with Sweden and Finland. I mean, maybe you can somehow coerce Moldova into it. I don't know. But you're not going to get Ukraine. You're not going to get Georgia. Maybe you can talk Armenia into it, although I think Russia would make Turkey would make it impossible. Turkey will never allow Armenia to be a NATO member. NATO has reached its limit. NATO can't rebuild. All this talk that Stoltenberg's been putting out there, 500,000 ready forces, everybody building, the United Kingdom's got a new government. Keir Starmer has come out, I think Healey is his Minister of Defense, Secretary of Defense, and he said that we're going to do a root to stem, I don't know what that means, but a root to stem analysis of our defense needs so that we can meet the 2.5% GDP benchmark by 2030. That's 6 years from now, ladies and gentlemen, 6 years. So UK saying it's going to take us at least 6 years to get up there. But then he came out and he said, if our economy can handle it, and there's the answer, their economy can handle it. The British are in dire economic straits. The people aren't going to allow this expenditure. The British Army will continue to deteriorate, which it is right now. It's a shrinking military. They may have to mothball or sell their aircraft carriers that they just built to say, yay, the Royal Navy is relevant. No, it's not. You can't man your frigates. You have frigates in port because you don't have crews for that. You don't have crews for the aircraft carriers. Your army used to be 72,000. You could fit them into a major soccer stadium and still have 20,000 unsold seats, but it's shrinking even smaller. It's going to be down to around 54,000 in a couple of years, and you don't have a plan to make it grow. Nobody wants to join your military. Great Britain, United Kingdom. It's pathetic. That's the reality of being in France. Macron last year got Parliament to buy off on 419 billion euro investment for a five-year plan that would take them up to 2.19% GDP. But that was with a Parliament that Macron controlled. Most recent election, you have a deadlocked Parliament. I don't see the far left saying this is a good use of money and they can freeze up the Parliament. I think the French are stymied, deadlocked. Germany, largest economy in Europe. The leader when it comes to, setting the tone and setting the pace. And, Boris Pistorius, the defense minister, is we are going to do this 2.5%. We're going to make this happen. Scholz came up with a 100 billion euro emergency plan fund. It's a one-off, though. I mean, when that money's gone, it's gone. And they're already burning through it and they're getting nothing out of it. I mean, it's amazing how expensive modern militaries are. But when that money's gone and it runs out in 2027, they're going to have to rely upon their defense. And it's like anything. When I was a firefighter here in in New York, you'd see the federal government put out these grants, and communities could apply for these grants to get money to hire firefighters to help bring your fire departments up to speed, et cetera. And that's nice, but then the money runs out because it's not permanent. It's not like, oh, we're gonna fund this for 20 years. It's we're gonna help you get up and running, and then in 2 or 3 years, we turn it over to you, and now you have this firefighter, but you're back to the problem. How do we afford this person? We have to raise taxes. We have to do something. We have to have money coming in that can pay the salary and the benefits and everything. And a firefighter is very expensive. And people found, they got this for a couple of years. They looked good. And then the federal money ran out. The local community couldn't support. And they have to shed those firefighters. They're gone. The community's back to where it started. This is the thing about, the Germans. They got this $100 billion. They're out there doing things. But in 2027, that money runs out. And so they have to have an expanded defense budget capable of sustaining that. Pistorius was looking for 6 billion euro increase this year. He got 1.2. That's below inflation. So understand what I just said. Germany, the largest economy, the one that's supposed to be taking the lead on the continent for expanding its military to meet the Russian threat, is shrinking because the money increase that they put into the budget is below what inflation has done to the power of that money. So they can't even afford the military they have. They're not growing. They're going to have to cut back. They're going to have to shrink. That's the reality of all of Europe today. Sweden and Finland, I mean, the Finns are hilarious. I love the Finns because they're so stupid. Not the people, but the government. 15 bases. We're going to open up 12 to 15 bases. Let the Americans and NATO come in. The Americans are going, I don't know if we like that idea, because once we get there, how do we sustain it? You guys are way the hell over there. We need to have like all of our equipment up front, but we don't like that because that's a target. Remember, we get back to targeting because there's going to be a Russian looking at it going, boom, 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 boom. Everything's dead. And then you're stuck there with nothing. How do we get them there? Oh, you got to land. And I mean, it's to support Finland. We have to land in Norway. Okay, all right, I got it. Then we have to go over the Norwegian mountains. That's tough, isn't it? Yeah, narrow roads, winding roads, tunnels, things like that. Yeah, not very wide roads too, very narrow, right? Yeah. All right, so we get over that. Well, now we come rolling down into Sweden, and we got to work our way down Sweden and then bring it back up and enter Finland from the side and then go out. That's long. Can the roads handle this kind of traffic? Nope. Can the bridges? Nope. So you got to spend money building all this up. Yep. And enter the targeteer. Me. And I'm going to sit there and go, that bridge over that river is sort of your weak point. If I blow that bridge up, you don't have any alternative crossing points. You're stuck. I collapse that tunnel. You're stuck. Finland's sitting there realizing suddenly we're in the middle of nowhere. And nobody's coming to our help. Nobody. That's like going out there and building a settlement in the American Southwest, back in the Indian days. And you got Cochise up in the mountains and Geronimo up in the mountains looking down. And you build a settlement and go, that's okay. John Wayne and the cavalry are going to come in and save us. And John Wayne's out there going, no, we're not. We're back here behind Red River, here where it's safe. You're on your own. And Cochise and Geronimo are like, let's go, boys. And down they go, burn the village, kill everybody. That's where Finland is right now. They're out there and it's starting to come to their light. Not only that, they went hardcore. We're NATO, so we're going to go anti-Russia. Well, I mean, let's just talk fundamentals. Ask the Finns how their wood supply is going. Now you'd say, well, Finland has a lot of trees. Not enough. Finland imported almost all their wood from Russia. And right now, for instance, we have to upgrade the base. Okay. We need contracts. Okay. For construction. Okay. And for each one of these buildings, we need X amount, square yards or meters or cubic meters of wood. Not okay. We don't have the wood. Russia supplies the wood, but we stopped the contract. That's just wood. Now we can get into every aspect of the Finnish economy that was integrated with the Russian economy, and their economy is going to collapse. So their military is going to be isolated. NATO can't come to their assistance, and their economy is collapsing. Yay. That's the reality of NATO. NATO expanded and became weaker by doing so, because now there's a need for NATO to commit to Finnish defense with resources that are shrinking. As I told you, the German military is shrinking. The American military is shrinking. Ladies and gentlemen, we can't recruit the troops needed to keep the American army up to its current manning levels. So we had to shed a whole bunch of positions in the Army and shrink it. And it's only getting worse. We're not meeting the recruiting. So the American Army's shrinking at a time when we actually need to meet our NATO commitment. We need about 120 to 200,000 additional American soldiers trained, equipped, organized, ready. We're shrinking. And so we've expanded this need. And it's like me buying a whole farm field and saying, I'm going to turn that into a place for my dogs to run. All I got to do is mow the grass, and I got a push mower. That's okay. I'm going to buy a riding mower, but I don't have the money to buy the riding mower. But I bought the damn place, and the grass is growing. And if I don't cut it, it gets overrun. And I got to get out there and push with the mower, but I don't have enough gas to keep that mower going. That's what NATO's done. We've expanded. We've proven that the Russians can't stop expansion. You just screwed yourselves, guys. You brought in two nations that have no viable militaries. You've now exposed your entire northern flank to a Russian attack. The Russians, meanwhile, are building up a 70,000-man corps in the St. Petersburg military district that will take Helsinki anytime they want to. Yeah, so that's the reality of NATO. NATO is the weakest damn military alliance in the world today. They have this 75th anniversary where they're pounding their chests. It is weak sauce, baby. Those people can't do what they want to do. And they're sort of acknowledging it. The statement is the collective defense industrial capacity of NATO is incapable of meeting the military requirements of Ukraine. That means NATO lost. They don't want to admit it, but they've lost.
When you see Stoltenberg talking about Australia, Japan, South Korea, New Zealand being invited to NATO in order to send a message to China, and how do you find, are they trying to change the rhetoric? Right now, they were denying that Russia is winning. Right now, they're pulling the blame that it's China, because of China, that Russia is winning right now. How do you find the current rhetoric?
If I took hallucinogenic mushrooms, I might be able to match Stoltenberg's rhetoric in terms of fanciful fantasy. It's impossible to put what he's saying into reality. New Zealand. How big is their military? Prohibit. Not very big. When they project military power outside of New Zealand, is this a war-winning capability? No. Australia, how big is their military? Again, not very big. When they project military power outside of Australia, is it war? No, it's not. Sorry. Japan, well, you know, they're working on it. They got a professional military industry, et cetera, but extremely vulnerable, especially to China, can cut off their sea lines of communication. And now with North Korea entering this new strategic relationship with Russia, Japan's very vulnerable. The Russians have told them, forget about the Kuril Islands. That's ours. You'll never get it back. And you got a United States that talks a big show, but in the Pacific, we're a receding power, leaving Japan and South Korea extraordinarily isolated. South Korea, again, has got great military industrial potential. In theory, South Korea could start producing equipment that could make its way to Ukraine, but South Korea will pay a price. We don't know what that price will be, but it's not something that Russia or China is going to allow to happen, on the surface of it. So, NATO, forgets again, guys, it's the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Why are they in the Pacific? Fundamental question. Because NATO isn't about European security. This is the reality. NATO is a tool of American hegemony. It exists to sustain American unilateral power around the world. And NATO's outreach to the Pacific is a reflection, not only of the fact that NATO has no viable mission, but that the United States is extraordinarily weak. We need NATO to project into the Pacific to offset our own fundamental insufficiencies when it comes to military power projection in the Pacific. We also need it from a diplomatic and political standpoint. As we sit there and start to negotiate with the ASEAN nations, Malaysia, Vietnam, the Philippines, Singapore, and others, they're looking at us, looking at China going, I think China is actually the stronger regional, and they're right here. You got to come all the way over. What we're trying to do is say, no, we've got Europe backing us up. We've got the world on our side. You need to align with us. So it's a lot of political flexing as well, but there's no practical move. And I'll show you the big fatal flaw in all of this. We speak of NATO. You mentioned New Zealand. You mentioned Australia. You mentioned Japan. You mentioned South Korea. You know, there's something called the Quad. It's four nations that the United States tried to rally into a singular cause. That would be Australia, Japan, the United States, and India. India, the last time I checked, I think it's Modi's in Moscow, hugging Putin, getting the biggest Russian award put around his neck, this Order of St. Andrew, and saying that we have this irreversible friendship. And this is on the eve of, Vladimir Putin is nailing down, commitments on the eve of the October Kazan BRICS summit, where India, which was a wild card in terms of, are they going to go along with BRICS expansion and BRICS empowerment? India is pretty satisfied with its role in the G20. They're a little threatened by China's role in the BRICS, and working with the Russians, I think, India is going to show up. Modi has been invited. That's a big deal. And I think India is going to start having a say in BRICS. That's the future. That's the direction India is heading, not towards conflict in the Pacific between China and the United States. So this NATO expansion is, again, a lot of hot air coming out of Stoltenberg. It's just not going to, I don't believe it's got any traction. I don't think it has any viability. And I think that it won't survive Stoltenberg's, term as Secretary General, which expires on 1 October to be replaced by Mark Rutte, the former Dutch, or I think he might be the current Dutch Prime Minister, who will take over as the head of NATO. But, this is just Stoltenberg style. A lot of talk. What has he accomplished? Look at everything he set out to do with Ukraine. And, he has been able to pour in a lot of money, but nothing he's done has succeeded. It's only made Ukraine weaker and made Russia stronger. I mean, that's the ultimate insult to Stoltenberg, is that this is a war that was designed to weaken Russia so that the West could strategically defeat Russia. But Christopher Cavoli, no friend of Russia, the commander of American forces in Europe, has come out and said, Russia's stronger today than they ever have been before. Their military is not only bigger, but it's well-trained combat experience. They're one of the strongest militaries out there. Wait a minute, I thought this war was supposed to weaken Russia. What about the Russian defense industry? Oh, it's up and running, all cylinders. It's dominant. The Russian economy is growing, gangbusters. And they're pumping out all the stuff that Europe can't. Tanks, airplanes, artillery shells, artillery systems, electronic warfare systems, drones, missiles. This whole thing has backfired. Stoltenberg has basically sown the seeds of Ukraine, NATO's demise. I'd be surprised if NATO's still here in 20 years, and it may not be here in 10 years. There's a chance that Mark Rutte will be the last Secretary General of NATO, because it is a fundamentally broken organization. And I don't think it can survive the strategic defeat that Russia's about to inflict on it through Ukraine.
Scott, did you hear this new report that it shows that China supplies 40% of all semiconductors needed for the production of key weapon system to the United States defense industry? It's huge. How did it happen? How is that possible if they want to pick a fight with China and Russia?
Because we're not strategic thinkers. Because we're greedy. Because we, want to make money without doing the investments. The way defense industry should work is it should be a closed loop within the capabilities of your country. If we're going to produce a tank, every component of that tank must be produced in the United States, because at some point in time, we have to assume that an enemy is going to seek to interdict our lines of communication, interdict our supplies. And so we have to ensure that we possess the capacity to produce tanks, even when the enemy is trying to prevent us from doing so. The same thing with sophisticated components. You know, we're not a nation that lacks in capacity. We have smart people. We know how to build things. We know how to produce electronics. It's just that we have, in the interests of, you know, cost savings, farmed out certain things. We don't want to pay an American worker, you know, the money necessary to have them do the high tech work required to build the semiconductors necessary. So we farm it out to China, to Mexico, to Japan, to others, to Taiwan, to produce these things because the labor costs are far cheaper. So now we don't pay as much. It's not a burden on the American taxpayer, et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, if we go to war against China, it's going to shut it down. And what Ukraine has shown everybody, just so you understand the consequences of this, the ammunition expenditure rate in a conventional high-intensity conflict is going to be beyond what we've been imagining. We're going to burn through everything because we don't produce enough. We haven't been preparing for a serious ground war. We've been preparing for short-duration conflicts. We will burn through air-to-air missiles that require these components. We will burn through precision-guided strike systems. And now we have to build them. So we're going to have to build the factories because we don't have the factory output capacity right now. Our factories are geared towards peacetime production, maintenance of existing infrastructure, not expansion. So we have to, in addition to building the factories, we now have to build the capacity and get the people capable of doing that, trained manpower. This is the Achilles tendon. This is it, man. Snip it, we're down. It's the stupidity of the United States. I mean, I'd like to believe that if we passed a law that said we have to have a closed loop here in America about every aspect of our defense industry, which is a common sense law, people say, well, that makes the military too expensive. And I would say, then why don't we build the military we can afford? You know, why do we have to do what we're doing, this posturing right now? Because it's unsustainable. Because if we go to war, we can't sustain the war. We're going to lose the war. Ladies and gentlemen, the Houthi have defeated us in a naval confrontation in the Red Sea in the Gulf of Aden. The Houthi on Nasrallah in Yemen beat us, beat the United States of America. And that's a defeat that will be reflected over and over and over again if we decide to expand the war. Iran will shut down the Strait of Hormuz. I'm sure China will be able to shut down strategic lines of communication in the South China Sea. We won't be able to keep those open. It's sort of self-strangulating. Why do we overextend? Maybe it's time to bring American military commitments back home and build that which is necessary to ensure our defense. Yes, look, it's a big, bad world out there. I do believe that the United States should maintain the capability of projecting meaningful power any place in the world necessary. Not everywhere in the world at the same time, any place in the world necessary. Maybe even two places in the world necessary. But these should be expeditionary forces that are based out of American territories. Are they expensive to maintain? Yeah, absolutely. Man, no one said defense is going to be cheap. In order to use them, they're going to have to train all the time. And I'm here to tell you, as somebody who trained all the time in the 1980s in the Cold War, when we were preparing to fight a real war, high intensity, training's very expensive. It ain't cheap to do it right. We need to spend the money on building adequate forces, making sure they're trained, and making sure that when we commit them, they can win, that it's a sustainable fight, that nobody can do anything to shut off our supply of, computer chips so that we can't produce the weapons we need. We need a complete revamping of America's defense commitments. And in order to do that, America needs to really look over how we interface with the world. And it's not just militarily, economically. You know, the greatest threat to the American dollar is America. This use of the dollar as a sanctions tool is self-defeating. Its use, we're causing through our actions the shrinking of the viability of the dollar as the global reserve currency. Today, it's still there. I forget the percentage. It's over. It's like 53-56%. But it's shrinking, and it's going to shrink even more because we're making it unattractive to hold the dollar. It's becoming inconvenient to hold the dollar. other people, you know, it used to be insane to talk about an alternative to dollar, because to do that, you would have to make new systems. It'd be very inconvenient, very expensive. And, you know, the proponents of the dollar said, don't worry about it. They have no choice but to do with the dollar. They got to deal with it. I sat in meetings where I heard, you know, big level people who advise presidents dismiss, you know, like alternatives. The dollar is too powerful. Dollar will be around forever until it's not. And right now we're in a situation where, because of our policies, we've made the dollar inconvenient. And so people, you know, nations that do business are realizing now that finding an alternative to the dollar, even though it's painful, expensive, inconvenient, is a better option than allowing the United States to threaten you through sanctions or threaten the seizure of your, you know, national resources, like they did with Russia. I love what the Saudis just told Europe. If you seize Russian sovereign wealth, we will divest from Europe forever. And the Saudis, maybe they don't have so much investment into Europe, but it would send a signal. And I think it would lead to a cascading of divestment, because what the Saudis are saying is, we can't trust you. If you do this, we can't trust you. And we're not going to trust you. We're not going to trust. And the beauty of BRICS is that we are creating alternative economic structures to Europe and the United States, where these kind of long-term investments and accumulation of wealth become attractive, because now there is an alternative to the United States and the West. So it's a long way of saying that this computer chip problem is a lot bigger problem than simply just computer chips. It's a systemic problem with how America interfaces with the world.
Yeah, you've mentioned how important is peace at the end of the day for the conflict in Ukraine. Orban is doing his best to bring some sort of peace to this conflict. He reported in a report on a Spanish newspaper, El País, he's talking about that Putin and Xi believe that peace negotiations between Ukraine and Russia will take place by the end of the year. Do you have any sort of hope that it would happen at the end of the day?
Well, there will be some sort of conversation. But the question is, what will the nature of that conversation be? You know, Putin has said, this is the best plan you're going to get. He put out a peace plan, and it's the best plan you're going to get. And Putin's not going to back down from that. You know, Orban isn't going to come into Putin and say, no, you got to change that plan. Putin's like, no, that's the best plan you're going to get. Z, same thing. Z's not coming. Ah, come on, Russia, give up Kherson. That isn't going to happen, man. That's the best plan you're going to get. So you could have a conversation now about how to implement this plan. And again, Putin said, that's on the table. Let's talk about it. But if you don't want to talk about it, then it's going to be taken off the table. And what's going to be put on the table later is going to be far different and not nearly as advantageous to you. So I do believe there's going to be a conversation by the end of the year. Look, Ukraine's in trouble. Their energy grid is collapsed. It's down below 50%, and the Russians are targeting it. And I think you're going to see by the time this summer wraps up that Russia is going to take it down as close to zero as it can be. Ukraine will not function as a modern nation state this winter. It'll have devastating impact on the people of Ukraine and on Europe as they divert resources to try and keep Ukraine afloat. It's going to have a demoralizing impact on the Ukrainian population. I mean, let's just be frank. Yeah, it's a tough day when a missile lands near a civilian target and there are civilian casualties. But there are discotheques in Kiev. There are restaurants in Kiev. They have a party life in Kiev. You go to Odessa and people are partying on the boardwalk. Ukraine is not a nation at war, because Ukraine functions. If Ukraine were a nation at war with Russia, Ukraine wouldn't function. It would have ceased to function a long time ago. Russia may make Ukraine feel like it's at war this winter. And it'll be very difficult for Ukraine's political leadership to ride this out, because the Ukrainian people are going to be looking to them for answers and they won't have any. And at that point in time, they have to go to the negotiating table. Will the current proposal by Russia still be on the table is the question. I think the best that Orban, Z, Modi, and others can do is to convince Putin to keep that on the table as long as possible, to hold off on any drastic measures. And I think Putin's a rational guy. Again, Orban, talking about Putin, said he's not irrational. He's a cold, he didn't say cold. He said he's a very cool character. He listens. He asks questions. He considers. He, you know, and he's looking for the best possible outcome. And the proof in the pudding is the Istanbul communique of 1 April 2022. Took me by surprise when I saw that. I was shocked that Russia, Putin, was willing to be that permissive with Ukraine. But they were genuinely looking for peace, genuinely looking for peace. Kherson and Zaporizhia would have been Ukrainian. The Donbass would have undergone some sort of referendum. It wasn't automatic that they were going to, they weren't going to be part of Russia. They'd be independent, but what their future was, it was on the table. And even Crimea, although it would stay Russia, Russia was willing to work with Ukraine on some sort of joint cultural heritage thing where they'd have a say in what, I mean, very reasonable proposals. Just Ukraine could not be a member of NATO. End of story. They lost that opportunity, but much of the Russian proposal that's on the table today mimics the Istanbul communique, with the exception being, of course, the territories of Kherson, Zaporizhia, and the totality of Donetsk and Luhansk, which are forever Russia, and their totality will have to be part of Russia. But other than that, the demands aren't that much different. Odessa will remain part of Ukraine. There's many Russians right now that take umbrage at that. Kharkov remain part of Ukraine. Dnipropetrovsk, Mykolaiv, Sumy, places with these large ethnic Russian populations will remain part of Ukraine. I think Putin's, the hidden threat in Putin's warning of not taking this is that what could be dictated to Ukraine could require them to give up Odessa, Kharkov, etc. But that is a completely different, I think the West is gradually waking up to the reality that Ukraine's not going to get these territories back. Kherson, Zaporizhia are Russia forever. Donetsk and Luhansk are Russia forever. Crimea, of course, is Russia forever. They're coming up to that realization. And so you're seeing discussions about this. They start off with freezing the conflict where it is. Russia's not going to accept a freeze. I mean, again, freezing is what happens when both sides are punch drunk. I just told you, in this war of attrition, Russia's winning. They're not punch drunk. They get stronger every day. But because Putin is a rational man who is genuinely seeking an end to this conflict, I do believe that if Modi and Z and Orban, Erdogan wants to be a part of this, if they can all put pressure on the West to bring about conflict termination that allows Ukraine to exist as a sovereign state, not part of NATO, never will be part of NATO, that's going to have to be captured in a treaty. And the treaties are likewise going to have to capture the fact that Crimea, Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Luhansk are Russian. All sanctions will end. This will be one of those Westphalian deals, designed to have that kind of impact on Europe, to bring an end to this fighting so that going forward, Russia and Europe, when we talk about a new European security framework that's reflective of this new reality. It's not meant for Russia to expand and control Europe. Russia never wanted to do that. So Europe will be able to say, we saved Europe, even though there's no threat. Ukraine will be, permanently neutral, aligned towards Russia. I don't think the Russians are going to allow Ukraine to tilt to the West. Especially if you're going to allow Odessa and Kharkov and Dnipropetrovsk to stay as part of Ukraine. The economic potential of these places is so great that Russia is going to want to ensure that economic potential feeds, feeds Russia more than it feeds Europe and the world. They don't want to allow Ukraine to, become cancerous again. They will be an eradication of these political elements. These ultra-nationalists will be eradicated. The methodology of that eradication, we don't know, but Russia can't allow them to exist. There can be no statues to step on Bandera. Organizations of that nature will be banned constitutionally. People who are in those political parties will have to undergo some sort of re-education or imprisonment or both, but or leave. But Russia isn't doing all this just to allow Ukraine to reemerge as a threat to Russia 20 years from now. Russia is seeking a permanent resolution to the modern Ukrainian problem. And if a peace agreement can do this by the end of this year, Russia's willing to sit down and talk about that. If not, Russia, look, Vladimir Putin has said he anticipates that Zelensky will be pushed out of office by the United States in the spring of 2025, which means he envisions this conflict extending at least until the spring of 2025. And Russia's willing to do that. NATO can't continue to support. We just, again, going back to the fact that NATO lacks the capacity to provide Ukraine with the means necessary to continue this conflict. Ukraine burns through material faster than NATO can replace it. So we'll see what happens. Russia's in the driver's seat. You know, the other thing NATO needs to understand is the longer this conflict goes on, the worse it is going to be for the NATO organization. We're seeing deep fractures. I mean, Viktor Orban's visit to Moscow is representative of one of the deepest fractures. And the consequences, you know, they're talking about kicking Hungary out of, you know, kicking Orban out of his position in the European Council. If you keep doing that, there's a chance that Hungary will leave the EU, leave NATO. I mean, if you continue to isolate them. And if Hungary goes, other nations will reflect on whether or not being EU members is viable. Maybe joining this new Russian, Chinese, Indian superpower that's forming up over here, that whose economies are working, might be in the best interest. NATO's put itself in a very difficult position. Very difficult position. Their best bet would be to try to negotiate the best possible outcome so that they can call a pause to this cycle of economic ruin and seek to rebuild economically, not militarily. There's really no need for NATO to exist as a military alliance anymore. And that's why I think that if there is some sort of peaceful outcome, you know, peace breaking out in Europe over Ukraine, that the reason for NATO's existence will be debated, and the expense necessary to keep NATO in place will be prohibitive, and eventually Europe will shed NATO.